Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, some perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, consumers hit the brakes as the Iran shock lands at the petrol pump. The immigration debate no one wants to have. Who keeps food moving? Credit providers face the heat as complaints expose pressure in the lending system. And plastic-free may be a fantasy, but plastic smart is becoming a business necessity. It's Wednesday, the 24th of June. Now, consumer confidence has taken a heavy blow, falling from minus 7 to minus 19 in the latest FNB Bureau for Economic Research Index. It's the weakest reading in 15 months. FNB says the Iran conflict, the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, the fuel shock price that came as a result, also a weaker JSE and higher borrowing costs have all fed into this decline. But I think the most striking detail is this, the sharpest collapse coming from higher income households, the group that normally carries discretionary spending in the economy. So I guess the question we need to be asking, is this a temporary shock or a bigger warning that the South African consumer is more fragile than we thought? I'm in conversation now with FNB Chief Economist Mamelo Matinka Ngwenya. Mamelo, a very warm welcome to you. Are we in danger of overstating Iran here when South African consumers were already under pressure before the shock?
Sure. So I think that's a very interesting perspective. I think maybe if we take a step back and we look at drivers of consumer activity over the past year, inflation was moderating, monetary policy was relatively accommodative. And I think as a result, consumers' debt service costs to income were starting to come off a little bit, essentially giving support to consumer activity. So as a result, we saw household consumption expenditure actually in 2025 rise quite considerably. And if we look at household consumption expenditure as a percentage of GDP, that was significantly north of 60%, so a significant driver of economic activity. With that said, I think the point that you make is that is there an overstatement of the Iran war and, you know, the resultant outcomes that we're seeing from the CCI? I think the biggest takeaway from us there is that disposable income is certainly being eroded by the increase in things like transportation costs. And at the same time, inflation is increasing, and that will have a bearing on real disposable income. And we know the central bank has now increased interest rates in response to higher inflation. And the market and some analysts are also pricing in another interest rate hike. So those supportive factors of consumer activity in 2025 will probably start to see a slowdown in 2026 as those support factors start to fade a bit.
So does that then tell us that the so-called resilient consumer was never as resilient as we initially thought?
I mean, I think one has to sort of look at the different income groups, right? So I think if we look at your middle to low income groups, I think affordability pressures are going to be a theme throughout this year. And consumers are certainly going to be quite discerning around how they spend their money. And I think in your high income earning segment, there is a balance sheet story there that we need to take into consideration. However, I think a common thread between the two is the labor market. So if the labor market is not producing opportunity, that will weigh on overall, spending activity. I mean, there's relative resilience in your high income earning segment, obviously worn down a little bit, but by what we're going through. the lower middle to lower end income households, that's going to be a function of sort of what how we see inflation plays out. So we've seen the petrol price shock, but that has also been cushioned to some extent by food inflation that has been relatively low. If, you know, we see second round effects, we see food inflation starting to lift next year, and monetary policy that remains quite restrictive, and the labor market that doesn't produce positive outcomes, that resilience will certainly be tested, I think, more strongly in your middle to low income households.
And the reality is certainly in the near term, that lower income bracket hasn't really felt the full impact of the increase in food yet, that secondary inflation that you talk about.
That's it. So we've seen food inflation still relatively muted, but you know there is concern that you know fertilizer costs that could potentially increase and result in higher food prices next year. That's a risk. There's concerns about El Nino. A lot of agri economists are speaking about this. You know, round of weather forecasts could certainly be a risk to the inflation outlook. So if we start to see that lift in food prices, that lift in second round effects, it's certainly going to take a toll.
What I find particularly worrying is the pullback as far as affluent consumers are concerned. If that is the case, and if it sustains, who is left then to drive discretionary spending in the economy?
So I think, you know, if we look at your asset-backed type of activity, so whether it's purchases of big-ticket items, I think consumers are certainly going to be quite discerning around how they participate. So if we look at things like vehicle sales, for example, we saw last year that vehicle sales were growing at double digits. We're starting to see that moderation come through. And I think if we look at the property market as well, activity is not as strong. So consumers across board will probably be very discerning. So we forecast household consumption expenditure of around, you know, one and a half, give or take, this year. However, next year we anticipate that, you know, monetary policy should start easing in the early parts of the year. And as we start to see consumers becoming, I guess, a bit more optimistic about the economy, more particularly your high income earners. I think, you know, the strong story that we started with at the beginning of the year takes hold next year, that spending activity should start to reemerge in 2027. So we expect a moderate activity, you know, through the different consumer components or consumption components. But next year, we think, you know, monetary policy should start to ease and we should see that activity come through.
And that's where we're going to leave it. Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's immigration debate is becoming, I think, louder, angrier, and more political. But interestingly, there is also a food security question that often gets ignored. Dr. Mark Vecheroff, who's principal investigator at the Center of Excellence in Food Security, is arguing that migrants are not simply a burden on the economy. Many are embedded in our food system, from farms and market to transport, retail, and informal trade. And this raises, I think, a difficult question. If South Africa cracks down on migrant labor without understanding how food actually gets processed and distributed, could the country end up hurting the very people it claims to protect through higher prices, labor shortages, and weaker food access? Mark, a very warm welcome to you. And I think this is an important issue, but one that is probably ignored. Do you think that we're sometimes sold a false story about migrants and the food system in this country?
Well, often there's no story or very little said about migrants in the food system. Yet, as you said in your introduction, they do play a very large role. You know, and we've been doing a lot of research, especially in micro enterprises and the street vendors, market traders, and so on. And there are a lot of people from other countries who are playing a key role in that, and a key role in often making food more affordable, because we found from our price tracking that, you know, for example, fresh produce is considerably more affordable from your street vendors buying through our municipal markets and so on, and directly from farmers, than it is in the supermarkets. So, and it's accessible because it's close to where people are living, especially in low-income areas in our townships and our informal settlements. And a lot of the people in that business, not all of them, they're South Africans there as well, but a lot are people coming from other countries. You know? Right now, I'm standing on a farm, and we're talking to some farmers yesterday, black farmers, and they are extremely worried about the threats to their labor, much of which is coming from other countries in the region. And so something that you didn't touch on in the introduction is their contribution also in primary production on farms, and whether it's people from Lesotho in the Free State, from Mozambique, from Zimbabwe. We have a lot of people who play a very key role in agricultural production, as well as then in the retailing and distribution.
Are you able to quantify that last fact, how much of our food supply then actually depends on migrant labor and how big the risk is?
I wouldn't want to put quantities on it, because we don't have reliable numbers overall of the sort of the total number of migrants employed in the sector and so on. So, so I'd be reluctant to put quantities on it, but we can certainly see a very large role. I do also want to just clarify that when we're talking about migrants and people from other countries, many of the people we're talking about have been here for decades, yes, in some cases. So very much integrated into the society, and we see more integration, for example, in Limpopo and Mpumalanga. You get a lot of people of Mozambican descent who are closely related ethnically and so on with South Africans, and long histories of movement backwards and forwards across those borders. So it's not always people who've just arrived now, and we need to be clear on that. Many of these people are integrated in the society. And the other important thing about that is, from an economic perspective, they're not extracting profits at any large scale out of communities. Often they're living in the same communities, which means they also spend in that communities. When they do employ people, they're employing people in those communities as well. So there's a wider economic contribution.
We are having this conversation ahead of the June 30 immigration deadline, and I've got to wonder, if migrant workers disappeared tomorrow, what would happen first conceivably? Would it be labor shortage, higher food prices, or empty shelves?
Well, first, definitely, partly maybe because I'm in the middle of visiting different farms, the labor shortage is a serious concern. So, to farmers I spoke to yesterday and a couple of days before in another area, were definitely saying one of the, saying what are the sort of challenges they're facing as black farmers. And, they're facing electricity cost and access challenges. And then the second thing many of them are raising is labor in the current situation, where they're worried. And because of the mobilization, it's also even threatening to people who come from other countries who might be here even on a legal basis, but because if you have a large number of people mobilizing and looking for foreigners and illegally demanding to see identity documents, that becomes a threat to everyone, especially if they have an accent someone thinks is different, or unfortunately in some cases they have a darker complexion. So farmers are saying they're very concerned about the labor loss, and some of this is skilled labor. People who've been many years on the farms also know how to run the irrigation systems, the planting systems, and so on. And then definitely, if our street traders are off the streets tomorrow, people are going to be paying 50% more on average for things like fresh produce, as well as probably having to travel further. So that's a serious impact. It's not going to be empty shelves. Our supermarkets are going to have food on the shelves, I think. I don't want to be over dramatic about it, but if a large number of street vendors, and in many cases a large number of them are originally from other countries or descended from people from other countries, if they're off the streets tomorrow, people will be paying 50% more for a lot of things. And if spaza shops close down, then that place where 100 meters from your house you can buy maize at a lower cost than it is in the supermarkets, and then if that's gone, you're going to have to travel further, carry your maize further, pay more for it. That is an immediate impact in the a crisis situation already, where we have over 60% of the population food insecure. So that is a very serious concern.
There is, as you've suggested, high dependency here within the value chain. As uncomfortable a question as this sounds, do you think farmers and food businesses rely on migrants because they're skilled, or simply because they're more vulnerable?
I think it's a combination. I think there's exploitation of migrant workers because they're in a vulnerable position, and that we should deal with. That's a labor issue, and we should not have extreme exploitation of anyone, South African or from elsewhere. So that should be addressed with better inspection and enforcement of labor laws and so on. But there's also skills, people who've been doing this for a long time, and people also coming from other countries where they've been farming. And we've got to understand, South Africa is now a largely urbanized society. thanks in part to our history of forced removals and so on, you know, many black South Africans were removed from the land, so haven't grown up in families of farmers and so on. When you talk to many people working on farms and farmers, then they come out of those families. And then I think we also have to take a step back and look at what happens with migration around the world. It is very common in many countries around the world that people from other countries migrants take up particular roles in the economy. So you can look in America, the dependence on Mexican labor, for example. Zimbabwe has a long history of dependence in their agricultural system on Malawian labor, just as in northern parts of South Africa, we've also had many Zimbabweans. So this is not a strange thing for a range of reasons, you know, including the limited opportunities for migrants or particular skills and experience that migrants bring, that migrants would take up particular roles in parts of the economy. This is nothing strange. There's nothing unique to South Africa. And I think, I mean, you can go to another extreme, talk about Silicon Valley and its dependence on migrants from India. So these are quite normal things in an economy. And in many ways, I would say we need to embrace them, but then manage it in a good way that it does contribute effectively to the economy, that there is skills transfer. I mean, I always want to be saying, like instead of complaining about a spaza shop owner who happens to be from Somalia out-competing others, learn from them. Learn what they're doing right. It's quite amazing that someone can travel overland from Somalia, arrive here with nothing, set up a business, and out-compete a supermarket group. You know, there's a lot we can learn from that to, you know, diversify our economy as well.
Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Mark Vegerhof, who is Principal Investigator, Centre of Excellence in Food Security.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, credit providers are under sharp scrutiny, and the numbers are uncomfortable, to say the least. The National Financial Ombud Scheme says complaints against credit companies jumping 58% last year. Even more striking, perhaps, 62% of complaints upheld in favor of consumers. Now, this suggests this is not just a handful of unhappy borrowers. I think it points to a deeper problem in the credit market, where consumers are being hit by unlawful vehicle retention, excessive payment extensions or repayment extensions, weak evidence in fraud listings and billing that continues even after default. Let's put all of that on the table. I'm in conversation now with Kwanda Vabasa from the NFO's Banking and Credit Division. Kwanda, a warm welcome to you. When 62% of complaints are upheld for consumers, is this a warning sign, do you think, of systemic abuse?
I think, yes, the statistic is a concern, but I think what we can draw from it is that consumers who have had issues with their credit providers have been assisted. They have found assistance with the NFO. And again, in half of the matters that we found, that we assisted the complainants with, we did find that actually there was wrongdoing on the part of the credit providers, and obviously administered or came up with the resolutions that we made, that we recommended. I think what I do need to say, Jeremy, is that the statistics do not clearly say or do not show or say that there is wrongdoing on all the credit providers. No, that is not what we were trying to say. What we are saying is that yes, majority of the credit providers out there, they do comply with the law. But those that came to our office, the matters that were dealt with by our office, we unfortunately found that in a majority of them, there were clearly transgressions on the part of credit providers, which then obviously warranted us making findings against them.
So is it transgressions or credit providers simply making mistakes, and maybe the transgressions because consumers are fundamentally weak and perhaps don't understand the process?
I think I would stick with the word transgressions, because the expectation will always be that credit providers must understand the environment that they're operating in. So they must understand that there is the NCA, the National Credit Act, that they must apply, and that obviously they need to understand how to apply it as well. But again, in the matters that we've seen, for instance, with the vehicle repossessions, there was clear transgression. You could see that there was either lack of understanding or clear disregard of the NCA, because there was never the NCA processes followed. And when the consumers attempted to address these issues with them, that the consumers were not assisted. It is only after those matters ended up with us here at the NFO, and we then had to again argue our case with those credit providers, put forward justifications as to why we believe that they transgressed the NCA, that they then accepted the fact that actually there was non-compliance on their side and then wrote off those debts.
And Kwanda, let me pick you up on that vehicle case that you've referred to. As I understand it, the car was held without a court order or voluntary surrender. How does that happen in what is a regulated industry?
Jeremy, it's so funny because this is not the only case. I mean, we do see such transgressions happening, and they do, unfortunately, continue to happen. But unfortunately, a lot of the people are just unaware of the assistance that the NFO can provide them. But yes, in this instance, the car had an issue, and the consumer obviously sent it to the credit provider for them to fix. But because the consumer, for some reason, did not then make the payments, because, again, this was a taxi, and this consumer was using this taxi to make a living. So they needed the taxi for them to be able to then make the installment payments. But because they did not have the taxi, then they stopped making payments. Now, to the credit provider, that justified them retaining that taxi and not giving it back to the consumer because of the arrears. But that is not the law. That is not the law. And again, it is a shocker that, yes, like you just mentioned now, in a regulated society, there are credit providers who still believe that they can adopt such stance. But fortunately, in this instance, I mean, the consumers were aware of the existence of the NFO, and we were then able to assist.
Now, as I understand it, and you'll correct me if I've misread this, store cards and retail accounts top the complaint list. Do you think that retailers are becoming credit traps?
Not necessarily. I think retailers, they play a very important role in ensuring and increasing access to credit for consumers out there. I think, yes, most South Africans definitely are not able to pay cash for a lot of the things that they do require. So, no, it is definitely not a trap. But I think on the cases that we've seen, there's clearly issues when it comes to the administering of those accounts, the charges being added to those accounts, whether it's the value-added products that the consumers never agreed to but were added onto those accounts. And in some instances, I mean, it's just an issue of understanding from the consumer. But again, I mean, in terms of our law, the NCA, if a consumer did not understand what they were taking up relating to the credit, that obviously also amounts to reckless lending. But in a lot of the cases, these issues definitely could have been avoided had there been proper communication from the credit provider to the consumer.
I want to ask you a question as we end this conversation about fraud listings, which can destroy someone's financial life. And the way I see it is that providers are listing people without strong evidence. And I think it's got to beg the question whether credit bureaus and fraud databases are doing enough due diligence before accepting these listings.
I mean, the correct approach would definitely be that if you're going to list someone at the SAFPS for fraud, then there must be very strong evidence proving that the person committed the fraud. But unfortunately, in the cases that we had seen as the office, we found that in some instances, there wasn't even actual allegations of fraud. It was, in some instances, people simply defaulting on payments. And then the credit provider then decided to then list them at the SAFPS. Now, as to your question on whether then the SAFPS should have then accepted that as fraud, that is obviously a very good question. But I can say that we, as the NFO, engage the SAFPS. And going forward, we know for sure that no such listings will be done, especially in instances where there is no strong evidence to suggest that the person or the consumer is involved in fraud.
Kwanda Vabasa is from the NFO's Banking and Credit Division. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, plastic-free sounds good, but one's got to ask the question, is it realistic? Now, one argument is that South Africa's beverage packaging future is not about pretending plastic will disappear. It's about becoming plastic smart. And what does that mean? Well, better materials, better bottle design, more recycling, obviously, and more recycled content and lower impact alternatives, such as plant-based and biodegradable packaging. But I guess there are also risks in this argument as well. Biodegradable doesn't always mean harmless. Nick De Beer is going to talk to us now from Fortis X. Fortis X is a specialist supplier focused on manufacturing and distributing bio-based, biodegradable and medical product lines. Nick, a very warm welcome to you. And I want to pick you up on that phrase, plastic smart. Is it a practical solution or is it just a softer, maybe more polite way of saying that plastic, whichever way we look at it, is here to stay?
We definitely believe that plastic smart is the way forward. Plastic free is not realistic. It is here to stay. It is mass produced. And in many cases, it's extremely useful. Of course, now when we recently had the COVID pandemic, of course, you want those ventilators, which are made predominantly with plastics, to be lasting, to be durable. And certainly plastic has its space and place in our economy and certainly in our environment and in our world.
I want to talk to you about biodegradable in just a moment, but do you think we may be giving up too easily on reducing single-use packaging?
Certainly in South Africa, of course, we've got quite a bit of catching up to do in terms of where the rest of the world is. You know, we've been very fortunate to be able to be part of the European Bioplastics Group. And there they are seeing recycling statistics north of 97%. Here in South Africa, unfortunately, households are recycling sort of around about 10%. So it may be optimistic, and certainly that's why we believe we're here, and to see if we can try and pioneer the future together and to work with the infrastructure that is in place in South Africa.
In the modern context then, Nick, what does biodegradable actually mean in real South African waste conditions?
So we're very fortunate in South Africa that we do have industrial composting facilities. Although some people are not aware of it, there are quite a few companies that are championing that. But biodegradable does not mean that it's going to deteriorate or break down in any environment. And we're quite specific about that, that it is compostable. So when it's compostable, it biodegrades or breaks down in a composting environment. So the industrial composters that are in South Africa are doing a phenomenal job of receiving that packaging, of ensuring that it truly breaks down. And Jeremy, we're seeing quite exciting results that in less than 1 month, there is absolute and total degradation happening in those compost facilities.
You're one part of the value chain, or the concept is one part of the value chain, Nick. Let me suggest to you that if municipalities in many cases can't manage ordinary waste properly, how are they going to manage specialist biodegradable packaging such as you're suggesting?
So that certainly comes with its challenges. In communities where even recycling is not taking place, of course, then waste management as a whole becomes quite a challenge. But we're pretty excited that the compostable packaging does have a phenomenally better half-life decay time. So in terms of chemistry, when that is measured in terms of total decay time, it is phenomenally better than, say, plastic, glass, or the metal alternatives. So while it is not necessarily the silver bullet in certain areas and locations where there's zero waste management, we are pretty confident that based on chemical half-life theory, that it's certainly the greenest possibility that they could be using.
Is there any risk that biodegradable bottles could contaminate existing recycling streams?
Yes, 100%, and that's very well known. That, of course, is one of the major arguments against biodegradables. So we're very excited that we have plant-based recyclable products that do recycle in the plastic waste stream. But, Jeremy, to your point, you know, if it was incorrectly labeled and ended up in the wrong recycling passageway, then that could be an issue. The same way, though, that other types of plastics, which let's say could be a crystal clear polypropylene, would be a problem if it was in the recycling stream with a different kind of plastic. So that sorting and the management of separating out the different kinds of plastics and compounds is essential.
Nick, let me ask you this. Is plant-based packaging genuinely scalable, in your opinion, or still at this point a nice-to-have niche premium solution?
It's scalable in the SME setting. So if we really wanted this to be as commercial as possible, there could be certain limitations. But many of the biorefineries that do produce resin are in excess of 70 kilotons annually. So while that is still a sort of drop in the ocean compared to the market size, certainly for SMEs, it gives us quite a considerable runway to still travel down.
And what's the broad cost difference for beverage companies? Who ultimately pays for all of this?
Generally, juice, dairy, water brands, sunflower oil brands, all of those kinds of food and beverage businesses are quite interested in going this way. And Jeremy, something that many people don't know is that it's phenomenally more affordable than glass. So while we can't quite beat the sort of general mass-produced plastic prices, we certainly have quite a serious cost advantage against glass. And we see the clients certainly pivoting towards going compostable and plant-based for those reasons.
Nick De Beer from FortisX, thank you very much for joining us today. And that is where we are going to leave it for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday, and we're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.